Hello, and welcome to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners Design for Culture. Today, I am joined by James Stevens. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. To get started, for those who don't know you, like I know you, could you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm James. I'm a city planner by training, but I work as a management consultant to a lot of museums, zoos, aquariums, recreational attractions, that kind of thing, doing market research, economic analysis, impact analysis for new visitor attractions or expanding visitor attractions. We do a lot of different things in our consultancy, but the cultural practice is a large portion of what we do.
And ConsultiCon, that's for those people who are already thinking, boy, I need to get this guy on the phone too sweet. That's the one word, like consult and then econ, right? Like
consulting, consulting, economics, and looking at the feasibility of projects is an important part of what we do. And we live in a pre-development space. So we work with a lot of architects and exhibit and experienced designers on projects before planning to set up some of the design conceptual development and then work on master plans often or evaluate master plans once they're completed so that the project owners, you know, the stakeholders, the whole set of audiences are engaged in that process.
Got it. And my favorite side question is how did you get into this business? I got into this business sort of backwards and sideways. How about you? How did you find your way where you are?
Yeah. Well, I've been doing this, you know, now 20 years ago. I went to grad school at MIT for city planning, and I was looking for jobs afterwards. I did a lot of practical work with groups of students that did client-based projects and working in main streets. Often MIT focuses on marginalized communities throughout the state of Massachusetts. So did a lot of work in low-income communities and communities of color, which we still do today, actually, on certain projects and cultural museums, African-American tribal museums, and the like. I graduated from MIT and I was looking at affordable housing opportunities. And then I saw this consulting opportunity, ConsultiCon. And they said, thank you very much. The position has been filled. And I was like, oh, okay. And I moved on. Okay. But then 2 weeks later, they said, oh, the position's open. So I interviewed a couple of times with different people. And then they hired me. And I've been doing it ever since. I found the job on the internet through Plan Edison, which is still a planning hub of information jobs and the like. But this is before, LinkedIn and Facebook and everything, getting jobs in a very different way.
Wait, there was an internet before Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting time, right? Because I grew up with the internet. I thought AOL was the internet at first, right? I mean, like a lot of people, the sound of the dial-up and then the DSL.
I know a show's going to go well when somebody starts doing vocal impersonations. I know it's going to be good.
It started as email, right? A lot of email. Right. Still do a lot of email today. But didn't have these devices.
Sure.
Didn't have the social media when I was coming up, I guess, on getting into the business. When I joined the business, we were still collecting data from books and magazines and putting them into a computer. But then we got reports. We would call up and they'd give us an Excel spreadsheet with all of the population and demographic data. And today you can just get that at a click of a button. A lot of it's free and generally available. So to go back channeling Tom Martin, who's the founder of ConsultiCon, the business has become from a triangle to almost a straight line, because he used to send out 10 research associates to Boston Public Library to go back and get the census data from books. And now what we do is readily available. You don't need as many hands to do that. And it's really about interpreting that information. That's not the subject of this show,
That's very interesting, though. So just for our listeners, we talk a lot about planning of projects and creative ideas and things like that on this show. But what you're really bringing to the project is that economic planning, the feasibility, and lest it go unsaid, any major project, especially a capital project where you're going to spend 7, 8, 9 figures of money, decimal places of money, you want to make sure that that's going to be well spent and it's logical. So y'all at Consulticon, you're trying to figure out how many potential visitors are there within a certain drive range, and what should be the correct mix of retail opportunities, and how should it be staffed, and what will that cost in that particular labor market, and stuff like that. Have I got that?
Absolutely, Jonathan. You know what it is that we do.
Got it. Okay, cool. So that's that, because I just want to make sure that our listeners know where you're coming from, because of the title of our show for today.
Right.
And I think we should get right into that. So the episode that you would like to do today is an economic planner's advice to museums with James Stevens, because that's you. And as always, I have the list and my guest has the rest. And you have 5 points on your list today. If folks who are listening doing jogging or yoga want to keep track of where we are, we got 5. I'll call them out to you. That's one of my jobs here. And number one in our list of an economic planner's advice to museums, number one is know your audiences, plural. You've got a parenthetical in there. Number one, know your audiences, parentheses, plural, and parentheses. Say more about why that is the first thing that you wish museums knew from the point of view of an economic planner.
Absolutely. I think the other name of this session that we talked about was 5 things that I wish clients would know ahead of time. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with kind of doing some homework ahead of time, but also understanding that you don't know everything up front and you're going to be retaining experts and the like along the way. But everything in these projects starts with the audiences, right? They're kind of why these are public facilities. We're attracting various people to them. And so we need to be laser focused on identifying and defining who our audiences are. We can call them stakeholders. We can call them market segments. We can think of them from a business perspective. We can think of them from a visitor evaluation studies perspective. That's a core audience, but there's many different audiences that are engaged in this project. So your audiences, your general public and audiences, you want to know what they want, what their needs are, what kind of joy you're going to give them or gap they're going to fulfill in their lives, their experience. These are educational organizations often that are developing exhibitions. And so how does the school system, the teachers fit in, the school groups that are going through the field trips? You have an in-place audience, an existing audience. Some museums look to do changing exhibitions, right? And sometimes that's more of a mass audience, right? The Marvel superheroes, which I saw, paid a premium for, and it was awesome, right? A lot of selfie opportunities with Hulk and seeing yourselves in the costume of Black Panther.
Yeah,
cool.
I did that
totally
too, by the
cool.
way. Totally cool.
Totally cool at the Science Center. Yep. And then, so what's the kind of relationship to your program? Because you have existing audience, program audiences. Does that exhibition serve any kind of your educational or other programs, public programming and events that you do? And the board members, right, are big stakeholders because they're often donors to the project or conduits to donors. Their donors and board members are audiences, but they're overlapping. And a lot of these audiences, right, people fall into multiple buckets sometimes. There's the broader community members, particularly if you're doing a development project in an urban place, there's residential neighbors that are going to be up in arms over a construction project or loud parties or whatever. So, you know, being contact sensitive to your community means when you do a big development project, and again, I'm talking about like new museums or big expansions or big renovations. And then government. Government relations is essential, particularly if you are getting funded by government. Often cultural facilities, museums are on public land. So the government is an owner, maybe. So they're a key stakeholder and getting political support. I've seen cultural organizations live and die by political support, particularly those that are run by government.
Wow, this is the list of audiences. Now I know why you put that parenthetical in there about plural. When you're doing your feasibility or your economic planning for a project, it's a great checklist you just rattled off. Stakeholders and even all the way down to the community, and then even board members and conduits to potential donors, government, local folks up at arms. That's a great checklist. And what I like about it is that it's all people. That like you say, like, it's interesting because from my point of view doing exhibition design and planning experiences, likewise, it's all about people. It's all about audiences. Like, in a sense, it's like a theatrical show, and we have to think about the audience first. And it's weird, but refreshing and correct to hear that from an economic planner's point of view, it's the same thing. The first point you bring up is audiences.
Well, I'd like to start that way because I think comprehensively about it. I work with folks like yourself and others that are design professionals because it takes all different sorts of expertise to bear on the project. And it's not about the physical. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, we're creating physical things manifested in space, but it's all about the activities, the people. What are the people there? What are the activities going on? But the root of all of this is feasibility. So, you know, when we start with an economic feasibility or market feasibility. Do you have demand? What kind of demand do you have? But thinking about it comprehensively, you see the board members, you see the donors, you see the government. They all have their own feasibility vector and analysis.
Do you guys think about, at Consulticon, are you thinking about the feasibility of the entire pie chart? Meaning the pie chart of revenue, that cultural organization is going to get revenue, whether it makes a profit on any individual thing or not, whether it receives more than it spends in one of these categories is a different matter, but any cultural organization would receive revenue in the form of donations, they would receive it in the form of ticket sales, they would receive it in the form of rentals. Let's say someone wants to get married and they want to get married in the Temple of Dendur, that kind of thing.
And the Rose Garden. The Rose Garden.
The Rose Garden.
Let's keep it simple.
People get married in the Temple of Dendur. I didn't. But that one does that. Are you looking at all of that feasibility? Because I know from, I have an amateur's view on this, but I know from experience that some cultural organizations have a really big share of the revenue coming from ticket sales.
Oh, yeah.
People are just coming in there gangbusters. And so during the pandemic, they had a lot of trouble because they weren't having people come. Whereas other institutions, I've worked with a few, that if no one came in a given week, they'd be fine because so much of their revenue pie chart comes from endowment.
Endowment. Yeah, those are interesting.
So are you looking at all of those different sources?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if it's a startup, then it doesn't really have much of a track record. But if it's an existing organization and institution, it has that base of operations and support, right? So you're right. One of the largest earned revenue sources is admissions. Some are free, right? So there is ancillary revenue driven by retail and food service. As you said, events and increasingly design over the years, of course, for a long time. Design scopes for new museums want to take advantage of events, have facilities, lobbies sized for events, you know, exhibit halls that are flexible or large enough to accommodate events, dedicated event and meeting facilities too, becoming a conference center or a training center. So that creates, and you talk about audiences, group, corporate, and that kind of business. Because there's a lot of business to be had having receptions for conferences or conventions at unique spaces like museums, rose gardens.
Right. And you also, one of your stakeholders was board members who either are or are a conduit to donors. And that's a, compared to the number of visitors who would come to a museum, that's a very small number of people, but they're very important to the financial sustainability of a nonprofit cultural business. I guess in a sense, you have to equally look at the feasibility and the viability of the board members and how much those in future, if it's a startup or next, if it's an evolving institution, what they might bring to the table in terms of the revenue through annual donations, et cetera.
That's equally
as important as the...
Well, the contribution, right? I mean, they're always, because CERN revenue doesn't support operating expenses, we have to generate contributed revenue, just industry. It's standard, right? And some organizations are fortunate enough to have an endowment, some with rather large endowments. That means that they don't actually, they can offer free program. They don't really have to worry about kind of market testing at one level because they make decisions in a different way. But it's not a business-driven kind of ROI. These are mission-driven organizations. So they make, but we're also contributions and donors and selling stuff too. It always starts with the members, right? And the membership and who are they and what do they want, you know? And if it's a science museum, there's going to be a certain segment of the families that are getting science memberships every year and going and having that experience. For many families, it's a rite of passage.
And you mentioned before a little jargon watch. You talked just a moment ago about earned revenue, jargon watch, earned revenue. And the way you described it, it sounded like that was half of a coin and there's another half. Is there an opposite of earned?
Three main kind of categories. Earned revenue, which is making money. Contributed revenue, which is raising money and fundraising. And by the way, project feasibility also, if there's fundraising involved, you need to do fundraising feasibility. And we work with fundraising council, other consultants to look at that, right? So that's just another thing. And then there's the endowment, investments and proceeds, and then kind of other revenue, which might be unrelated revenue.
Endowment, so, investment and proceeds is everything I was just talking about all related to the endowment, basically.
Yeah, interest,
so that's sort of like passive
returns.
Like
yeah,
passive
very passive.
Income?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely passive income. And if there is a big endowment, then it's the board's responsibility to be the fiduciary for that, or at least a subset if there's a committee.
Got it. So I guess a human, like an individual, like myself, would have, our sources would be earned revenue and maybe some investments, like a retirement fund or a savings account or something.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
a normal, just an everyday human wouldn't have contributed revenue. We wouldn't be raising money for ourselves.
Well, if you're going out to one of those crowdsourcing,
you could do a GoFundMe or
GoFundMe for whatever annual shindig you hold for the community.
You could pass the hat for some pizza.
Pass the hat for some.
And a for-profit organization would have earned revenue, but probably not necessarily much investment proceeds. Contributed revenue. So that
to be a not-for-profit organization in order to raise the donations.
Right. That's the thing that distinguishes a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Really interesting. I've been wondering about that. Okay. So point number two, you just taught us all about knowing your audiences, and it's plural. It's very plural, actually. Point number two in an economic planner's advice to museums is be both curious and skeptical. That's an interesting combination. I get curious, I get skeptical. Combining them, I think, is very interesting. I guess when I'm at my best, I'm both. But what do you mean by that when you say a museum should be both curious and skeptical when they're starting a project?
You need to go and do your homework and be curious about the project that you're doing and similar projects. So it's important to go and look at precedents. If you can go to museums and travel around the country, one of my clients went to some 20 plus cultural centers in very impressive to do that, a large expense and taking staff, 2, 3, 4 staff at a time, but worth the investment. It's an $80 million project. So they want to do it right. And you learn from others that have done it before, right? This is something that a museum doesn't do every day, but it is something people have done before. And there's the consultants that have done it before. And so at some level, you have to be skeptical of them.
Wait, if I understand correctly, ConsultiCon, where you work, is a consulting company.
Yes, it is. It is. You don't be skeptical of us. We're the skeptics, actually.
I think the cat's out of the bag.
We're the skeptics.
Everyone's
going to
be skeptical. Yeah, everyone. Yeah.
Everybody's going to be skeptical and eyeing each other from across the room. But we're all curious to learn about one another, who we are and what we do, right? And everybody does it a little bit differently. Everybody might have their own special sauce. Everybody might have their own black box or their process or their prototypical process, right? You and I go to the Building Museum Symposium and you sit in 5 sessions every year. And here's the development process. Here's the team you have to assemble. Here's how you put together a master plan. When do you need the team? Right up front.
Right, exactly.
Day one. But actually, I can tell you need ConsultiCon ahead of that, pre-design. Particularly if you're making big decisions. And our work underlies decisions. You pay short dollars. I'm going to be frank, less than the designers who get to build the thing and have larger fees. But, you know, we set up the project for success by ensuring that people have the best information to move forward with their project.
You just said short dollars. That caught my ear.
Oh, yeah.
What is that? Is that a term of art? Is that like an economist's phrase, or is that a
short dollars? Short dollars or fewer dollars, I guess that would be the case. Some folks do major multi-million dollar projects without getting the business planner, right? This is a business plan. Why would you not do like a $5 million project and a $10 million project? I'll tell you a story, right? Because I like to share stories. A major project, a master plan, it was 120 plus million dollars, multiple phases. The first phase was 25 million. And they had done that without the business plan, a business plan, evaluating what they had all these designs, right? They were into conceptual, schematic. They were moving forward and ramping up. I mean, they had done the $25 million phase one. And they were ramping up to do the next phase, but they needed to raise more money, right? There's a big gap between 25 and 125,
mm-hmm.
right? To get yep. from point. So needless to say, there was dissension in the ranks, which was unfortunate because everybody at the leadership of these organizations should all be rowing in the same direction. At least they can disagree behind closed doors, but you know, when making decisions like bringing on a consultant, and then having a meeting with the staff and the board leadership, right, on day one, really, what do we have to talk about? This is what we're going to do. And then a board member says, well, I don't understand why we hired these consultants, because we raised $25 million on our own. And
did they think that you were consultants in fundraising feasibility?
No. There was actually a fundraising feasibility council that was part of the whole process. Actually, uh-huh. He was doing his work.
Got it.
He was actually in the meeting. He was in the meeting, and that was a hard meeting, needless to say. But you know, at the end of the road, that project, that $50,000 that they spent for our services, resulted in the city investing $13 million. So this work supports major multi-million-dollar investments. And if you're going to raise money, you have to be a good steward of them. And increasingly, donors are asking, well, where is my money going? How are you going to operate and maintain this? Let's add on not only the cost of constructing the beautiful places, the cost of Jonathan and me and other fancy consultants, the cost of the more endowment, but the cost of the operations over the lifetime of the exhibit or the museum or whatever that capital investment. An IMAX theater, right? A planetarium.
I think this all falls within that category. So it sounds like the business planning, you just relayed an anecdote
yeah.
about a client
was skeptical.
Yeah, they were skeptical. Some of the stakeholders were skeptical, yet the work that you did resulted in a big windfall. Was that big windfall because that was an organization who, unless they'd been shown a business plan to be prudent and responsible to show that due diligence had been done, that they would not have been inclined to make any contribution? I think you said that was a...
No, yeah, that's right. That I mean, it's a requirement for a lot of public, yeah, for a lot of public funds, there's a requirement to do some sort of impact statement or study. What is the return on our investment? And when it's, you know, a not-for-profit organization or a visitor destination, a lot of that impact is the spending of that people do while they're on a trip to a museum. It's not the spending necessarily that they do on site. I mean, that's the operations of the museum, but it's the visitors that they draw, particularly those folks from out of town, because they're coming from out of town. They're extending their stay. They're taking a half day to go to an attraction. They're spending their money. And so we claim that day's worth of money and spending. And that's economic impact.
Do you have a formula for, I mean, a particular market, let's say, or doing a project in, I don't know, Oklahoma City or something? Do you have a formula to say, well, if a visitor comes from a couple hours away and there's this new museum, or the museum adds a wing, or there's some reason for them to come,
sure,
that if they stay in a hotel, on average, it'll be this much. And if their family stays, it'll be that much. And you have some kind of a formula to figure out how those things might all add up. Is that, you have kind of
That's right. We have a formula. That's for sure. It's a bunch of tables in a spreadsheet.
Right.
With many formulas.
And how do you determine what that, I don't know how to phrase this question. How do you determine whether it's right or not? In other words, I've said, we're going to open, I don't know, I always use this funny example. We're going to open the Museum of Forks in Oklahoma City. I've got the most famous fork collector in the whole world, biggest collection of forks ever, including the famous fork of Louis XIV or something.
This is a dream scenario.
What, I don't know.
Or is this reality? Do you have a fork?
It's a fever dream. No, I have no actual forks were harmed in the creation of this metaphor. But we're going to have the Museum of Forks, and it's going to be absolutely terrific. There's forks everywhere, merchandise. I mean, just imagine what you'll find in the restaurant. Obviously, lots of food that you eat with, wait for it, forks. It's going to be terrific. But how do you determine from an economic feasibility standpoint, like, I know how many people will come to that? Run through the steps of that. Okay. Like, well, this many people live within a two-hour drive of Oklahoma City. And of them, this many are probably interested in that. Like, how do you actually figure that out? Because I know from experience that Consulticon's numbers are very reliable. How do you make them so reliable?
Well, like everybody else, we have a crystal ball. There is something about predicting the future and just knowing what the kind of historical data is, what current data is. So when you're thinking about, we always predict a visitation within a range, right? Because we use a mid-range for planning purposes, and that's the basis for any kind of operational analysis, estimates of revenue and operating expenses. And there is a set of, in Oklahoma City, I actually really like Oklahoma City and have worked there a lot over the years for the First Americans Museum. And we looked at an aquarium there as well. Local attractions, museums there will get a certain level of attendance, and then they will get some attendance. And most museum visitation is within like a drive time. Unless you're in a major metropolitan area or tourism destination where there's millions and millions of visitors coming in, most attractions or museums at their base are locally serving, right? Local audiences. That's where members become really important. Community relations, government relations become really important because there's always the motto in kind of planning, and you know, if you make places for residents, the tourists will come. So that makes tourism destinations more palatable to locals, particularly when tourism can run amok in certain places. They call it over tourism, if you've heard of that term.
I have not heard of that term, but this is great. Are any of these James-isms, or are these all...
No, over tourism is a thing. over tourism okay. thing.
For, so if I walk into sure. my next meeting and I pretend yeah. like I've known that term for a long time yeah. and I say, well, of course, we don't want to have over tourism, yeah. then everyone will say like, oh, very good. Yes, we do not.
Right.
They won't look at me like I have no idea what I'm, this is a, everyone knows this word. I'm going to look smart if I say that word.
Yeah. Yeah. So to go back to Oklahoma City, there's also dark tourism, right? So there's, and that's, that the Oklahoma City Bombing Museum Memorial is a really, really special place, actually. I cried. It was terrible. It's one of the reasons why I don't go into the 9/11 Museum. But that museum gets about 100,000 people. And it's like a once and done place. So like a Fork Museum is probably once and done. The zoo, and I don't know off the top of my head what the zoo gets, but you know, it's a big metro area and it's a good zoo. 500,000 people. Is our Fork Museum going to get 100,000 500,000. I would say no, based on my judgment of, you know, all of the utensil museums that I researched.
How dare
and lo and behold, Jonathan, I found 5 fork museums, 3 spoon museums, a knife museum, which is surprising given the utility of a knife.
Thank you. Bless you for playing along. But sometimes you must have. That's what's gonna. That I was. I take notes. I'm listener number one here, so I'm taking mm-hmm. notes all the time mm-hmm. on what my guests say. And I was going to ask you earlier on about if you're doing a feasibility study, there. I mean, by the nature of that, one presumes that there are situations which are infeasible, like they are, or okay. unfeasible. They are not feasible. They cannot be done.
Right.
My Fork Museum as a representative Boy. of the collector of forks, I'm appalled that you would not have the faith that we have in our Fork Museum. And
just you're gonna, this, just I am not one to judge the ideas of exhibit designers.
We are gonna my donor and I are gonna take your fine numbers and crumple them into a ball and throw them away and proceed anyway and then have to sell off the building to a Foot Locker franchise yeah, in 5 years.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you whether or not it's a good idea. I'm not going to tell you whether or not it's feasible, actually. I'll give you the information for you to make that decision. My colleague Bob Ray always says none of these projects are feasible because they don't make enough money. They don't generate enough earned revenue to pay the staff, to keep the lights on, to cover all the operating expenses. So there's no ROI from a pure business perspective. Now, Bob has an MBA. I have a planning degree. And I'd say, well, anything's feasible if you just put your mind to it and you figure it out and you throw a whole bunch of money at it. I mean, there are museums that are totally funded by single people.
A lot of people hear this term, ROI. We hear that term all the time. Could you define just that one term for our listeners?
Return on investment.
Say more about that. What does that mean?
So if you invest money, right, like in the stock market, you expect some sort of return. And in the stock market, that's either in the form of dividends or in higher values of the stock. So in real estate development, well, say you invest $10 million in some real estate, apartments, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It generates net income $1 million a year from its operation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the return on that investment is 10% a year. And so that's better than interest rates, which are pretty high, actually, 4 or 5% on a bank account these days.
Mm-hmm.
8% on a mortgage, 8% on a mortgage.
For posterity, it's almost May, late April of 2024. Oh, for anyone listening in the future, you may hear those interest rates and think, "Oh, if only." But that's where we are right now. Okay, let's get out of jargon watch and get to number three. Then we'll do a halftime show. So number three,
okay.
Your advice you have for museums is formulate your mission test. What is a mission test? That's something that an organization would use as a sort of a litmus test to judge whether anything that they're doing somehow contributes
is
to the
worthwhile.
Mission.
Right. It contributes to the mission. Right. I think there's an excellent attraction in Philadelphia, the Eastern State Penitentiary, and they have preserved over the past 25, I think since the mid-90s, so maybe going on 30 years, this historic prison. And they've only done maybe a third of it or half of it. And they really have excellent exhibits there that deal with mass incarceration and the iniquities that occur, that the United States has the most incarcerated people per capita. And that's just giving people facts like that that are quite impactful and jarring. And it's dark tourism we were talking about before, but it's also, there's a, in the industry, there's an association of sites of conscience that, so these are places of kind of horror, maybe atrocity, injustice, or these organizations that fight for justice or civics and that kind of thing. But they have every year the horror behind the walls, which changes the penitentiary into a Halloween extravaganza, a fright fest that was generating 70% of their operating revenue. So that was 70% from 1 month of basically what was a commercial enterprise, a money-making ROI enterprise. And that has been a struggle that the organizations had, the leadership level. Are we cheapening our mission? Or are we, by doing this commercial operation? And at a certain point recently, it became so successful that they had to throttle it and really downsize, downscale. And I think that they felt was to the benefit. So there's some things that financially you might not do if they don't meet your mission test, right? They might meet your ROI test. And you should always know how much revenue something will bring in. But, you know, is it worth doing if it's not meeting your mission test?
Got it. So it's a way to make sure that your revenue is driving your mission. Your mission isn't somehow being sacrificed to drive revenue. That's awesome. Okay, let me do a quick halftime show, or maybe it's a two-thirds show or a three-fifths show. Quick station identification. If you're just joining, you're listening to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners, designed for culture. If you find this show valuable, please help spread the word. You can rate the show in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can write a review in Apple Podcasts. And thank you so much to everyone who has made this show, Making the Museum, a five-star podcast on both those platforms. You can also just tell a friend to check out makingthemuseum.com for everything about this podcast and the newsletter of the same name. And if you think you have something you'd like to teach people on this show yourself, like James is doing now, hop over to that same website. What's that URL again? makingthemuseum.com, and hit contact. And now back to the show. Today, I'm talking with James Stevens about an economic planner's advice to museums. 5 points, two more to go. Next up is number four, our penultimate point, and that is you'll be able to take time, but not too much time. That sounds like advising museums to make sure that they keep up the pace, but there's probably more to it than that.
Well, it is a variant of the old maxim, time is money. Time is money. And consultants are paid by hourly rates. So are staff, too. And time is money insofar as that money gets more expensive over time. If you have, we're talking about not taking on debt, but if you have debt, tick-tock, you better pay it off quickly. So it's about moving quickly through the process, because once you get to certain points in the process, you don't want to go back. I think in any designer or architectural, the phases of design, right? Concept design, schematics, all of this detailed, oriented stuff. And if you go, there are going to be key decision points that you don't want to take those decisions lightly. And so you do want to do your homework. You want to be curious, but you also want to be skeptical. And you want to take your time, but not too much time. You have to do your diligence, but and sometimes these projects, if there's not clear leadership and decision making, not that top-down decision-making is the best kind of decision-making, because a lot of these are community projects, and I've seen some museums undertake master plans with a concurrent kind of community engagement process that reached thousands and thousands of people in that community, right, through public meetings and public surveys and the like. So are you making decisions by committee? Who's responsible? Who needs input? And if that group can't make decisions, then it gets to be problematic, right? And then it takes time, and then you wind down projects. They're like machines. Once you get it going, there's gravity in the system. What is it? It's not entropy. It's the opposite of entropy. It's momentum or whatever. Inertia. Momentum, right. The laws of physics, I guess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Things can go off the rails all the time, right? And we've been working on one project, and we realized it was a series of virtual workshops to collect ideas and do some brainstorming, became problematic because even though there was a group assembled that was the leadership group, they felt that they couldn't provide the input without getting the input of their team. And so that then made that whole basically planning process, that set of meetings, kind of like poof, well, okay, we have to do something different. Which then meant having that online collaborative tool then put in an analog format, like with stickies in the staff break room, because of the staff that didn't have computers. So that took time. That then also put us off track to getting the full plan done as we do this kind of large engagement process.
That's a situation where the client that you were working with didn't have a method really worked out to be able to go as quickly as a project
right.
requires,
right.
Special projects that pop up,
right.
Not every day, year in, year out kind of stuff that you do in your career, but a special project that's supposed to be done by a certain time has its own schedule, its own rhythm, its own sort of time yardstick. And it sounds like in that case, like that client that you were working with hadn't set up a way to be snappy about their response. They looked at the schedule,
but then
blew right by it. And that's what you're getting at here, that you will be able to take time, but not too much time.
They didn't trust the process. And then they decided, so there was an expectation that we'll be able to do these workshops, and that's the process, and this is the ground rules, and you participate, and we collect the information in that forum, but then they wanted to go and do it in a different way.
Right,
so,
they want to have a side process.
Yeah, that's the thing. And some designers may not want to get marked up in community engagement and outreach and that kind of thing when meeting with people.
It's a two-edged sword. Anyway, it's something that has two somethings.
It's a double-edged sword.
And you can cut the coin into two pieces with the double-edged sword, and then you have two coins, and that's a lot of ROI. I want to get to point number five, and because this last point was about like not taking too much time. So point number five is establish. This was a bit of a shocker to me. The second part of it: establish strict budgets and fundraising goals, then change them. What does that mean? Establish the goals and then change them?
Yeah, goals. Well, oftentimes we'll ask people what their project budget is. And we don't know. We need to hire an architect or an exhibit designer to tell us that, what it costs. And then the architect and the exhibit designer come in and they say, what's your budget? And they say, well, we don't know. We hired you to tell us. And then, so the architect and the exhibit designer say, oh, okay, well, let's ask them what they want. And then they say, we want this and we want that and we want this. And then you get the kitchen sink and the refrigerator and the whole like 9 yards, and there's appliances and all sorts of stuff and goodies. The executive director or the board chair has a little suite. We need boundaries. We need parameters. But we also need to be flexible so that we can change them and what those parameters are. But is it give and a take? It's a chicken or the egg thing. When we come into a project, we often talk about right sizing of projects because we want to make ensure that you have sufficient amount of space to accommodate the demand, but not too much space. You don't want to be overbuilt. I've seen projects overbuilt. Do you need 25-foot ceilings in a hallway that is 20 foot wide? I mean, it's a monumental hallway, but I don't think you need it. I'm not sure what it gives to the visitor experience. That's just me. But part of it is the space, on how much space there is. Space is at a premium. So you need to have good space use. You need to be focused on what the space use is that is the most economical, but also the most profitable, but also the most refined from a mission test standpoint. Can we afford that extra $5 million for the planetarium? Is that something we need because it's core to our mission? Or is it something that was just kind of like space is a topic in our interpretive plan? And how do you talk about space? You do a planetarium.
Okay. It's almost a relief to hear that there is an objective way to look at it where there is a right answer. And that makes decision-making more finite.
Jonathan, as long as you tell people that I have the most right answers around, then we'll be good.
What he said. What he said. Okay, quick recap. This was our list for today. An economic planner's advice to museums with James Stevens. Number one, know your audiences, plural. Number two, be both curious and skeptical. Number three, formulate your mission test. Number four, you'll be able to take time, but not too much time. And number five, establish strict budgets and fundraising goals, and then change them. How do we do? Got them all?
I think we got them all. I don't know if we hit on them all equally, but I think we covered a good amount of ground. So
some of them were left a hasty sketch, and some of them we murdered them. All right. So James, it has been great to have you on the show. Awesome.
Well, Jonathan, this has been fun.
If listeners would like to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to do that? Because James here, he has the most answers of any economic planner. Email, website, LinkedIn, what would be the
email,
best?
Email, website, LinkedIn,
spell
phone
them
number.
Out. What's your favorite
spell
one?
Them out.
Spell them out for
okay.
people who are jogging
okay. well,
right now.
James
and like,
Stevens,
I
think you can find on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
By looking for me in ConsultiCon.
Yeah.
ConsultiCon is at consulticon.com.
Right. And that's ConsultiCon, ConsultiCon.
Yes. It's a capital E. It's a capital E in all one word.
Right. ConsultiCon, not e-com.
Right.
ConsultiCon. Okay.
E-com.
And I think people will find you in those places. And we'll put your contact info in the show notes also.
Sure.
So everyone
that'll be great.
Can get to you. Excellent.
That'll be
okay.
great.
All right. Okay. I think we covered it. Thank you, dear listener, for your time. In exchange, I hope this episode gave you some news you can use. If you would like to get in touch with me, have an idea for the show, or you think you have something you would like to teach people on this show, go to makingthemuseum.com and hit contact. You can also find me on LinkedIn under Jonathan Alger, A-L-G-E-R, or at the website of my firm, C&G Partners. And by the way, this podcast has an older sister, a one-minute newsletter with the same name, one quick insight three times a week, and a Sunday digest for museum leaders, exhibition teams, and visitor experience pros. And it's a great way to get word about new episodes of this podcast, like this episode. You can subscribe at makingthemuseum.com. Meanwhile, I'm Jonathan Alger. And I hope you'll join me next time for Making the Museum. Bye for now.